Hello and welcome to this edition of The Cyber Show. Today we'll be talking about the payments card business and regulation to help stop fraud. There's a lot of changes coming in 2025 with something called the PCI DSS version 4. That's the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard. We've got a great guest with us today, Martin Petrov. Martin's been working in digital payments for 20 years, trying to get everyone to understand the complex security requirements to keep their customers safe. That includes everyone from retailers in the high street to the financial institutions themselves. His company, Integrity 360, are among those who help keep businesses up to date with the ever-changing compliance requirements. Martin talks to us about audits and embedding verifiable security features into point-of-sale systems. Here's what he had to say to Helen and Ed.
Just wondering if you can just give us a little what you do for a living and your company.
Well, we help organizations to be more secure. We have quite a broad range of products and solutions and services which can improve the both security as well as the compliance posture of organizations, so that they can focus on their core activities. We are very good at it. We are passionate. And this is one way that we help the innovation and the freedom of payments. That's what I can say.
We hope everyone has watched Ross Anderson's lectures on banking and payments by now. But if listeners haven't, maybe Martin can give us a quick guide to how discoordinated, precarious, and terrifying banking software actually is behind the scenes.
So banking software behind the scenes is a real mess for several reasons. You need to think about the fact that it was designed many years ago, typically for a small volume of transactions. You need to think about the evolving technology and innovation in payments. And probably a big topic we'll talk about today is all of the security threats and how that landscape has evolved. There is a scary part to it. There is also all the nefarious things that we have heard or experienced, perhaps. There's all the regulatory side of things. It's a little bit like trying to have a Formula One race with a car that was built in the 1980s. So a lot of things can feel out of place at times. But look, we are where we are, and We've made amazing progress, and all the innovation, if you think just 5 or 10 years ago, has been amazing.
So is it a bit like, you know, adding new parts, a few modifications to an old car in a way to sort of patch up to the modern world?
Yeah. It's trying to race with a bit of old gear that doesn't meet all the modern requirements and, you know, probably how a racetrack was built back in the 80s was very different than what we have today. So and your competition, which you can think of both literally the competition but also the criminal world, they're moving on. Quicker. Also all the technology, and you're trying to keep up with all of this. I think it's quite a challenge.
Absolutely.
By Boudica Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
So when most listeners think of payment, they probably think of tapping a card on the machine in a pub or a restaurant. But what is that machine? Who makes them? And what exactly does it do?
Yeah, I understand your question. It's especially when you think about the size, it can look quite innocent, right? But actually, it's doing a lot of heavy lifting. First of all, you have different manufacturers. You probably have seen the logos of Ingenico, Verifone. And then you kind of probably as an individual, as a consumer and user, you kind of oversimplify things, thinking that, you know, you just tap the card and it's some magic happens. A lot of people don't realize that there's a bunch of processing happening on the device, and then it goes to a bunch of so-called players in the payment ecosystem. You can think of a payment gateway. You probably heard about a merchant bank or acquiring bank. Then you think about the logo on the card from Visa or MasterCard. So probably it somehow traverses their networks to reach the bank that issued your card. And then think about yourself being on the other side of the world. You know, how does that reach your bank to get an answer if you have the money or not, and come back often in milliseconds? And we also can think about, well, this has to be nowadays secure, encrypted. So yeah, when I say heavy lifting, I really mean it well.
So payment software is insanely complex, essentially.
Yes. And probably when you say payment software, you also want to think about hardware, mm-hmm. because nowadays actually so much depends on the hardware bit, mm-hmm. Because you do a lot of things in hardware. Either security or encryption or key management. Mm-hmm. And also when we think about software, it can be software in multiple places and doing different functions. Mm-hmm. Many people don't realize that, for example, a part of the payment software deals with fraud detection. It checks if your physical card is or your last payment is in one place, and all of a sudden it appears like you're making payments on another continent. Mm-hmm. Just imagine that complexity a lot. So then you have the software related to the so-called merchant bank, to the issuing bank, Visa and MasterCard in between, and some of the specialized service providers who kind of glue it all together. It can be insanely complex. And I'm not even thinking here about different currencies, languages. Remember, sometimes you make a payment, but it's split into multiple parts. You have to think about security and compliance. I mean, every single transaction can be so complex, and it has to happen in such a short time, and it has to always work. And it's a very complex chain.
So talking about that system, what is PCI DSS?
So PCI DSS stands for Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard. It's a standard that was first published in 2004, becoming effective in 2005. So it's nearly 10 years old now. And basically, it is a standard that was jointly created at the time by both Visa and MasterCard. Mm-hmm. They essentially unified their own individual security compliance programs into a single standard because it benefited the industry by having a single set of rules to comply with. What I mean by this is merchants, service providers, payment service providers, and issuing banks and merchant banks previously had to comply with two different set of standards, and now they had to do only a single one. And as you know, no merchant works only with Visa or only with MasterCard, so that removed a heavy burden. What was interesting is that later on, Visa and MasterCard were joined by the other major card brands like Amex and Discover, and they also created a regulatory body to manage the standard. This standard is the most famous, the most popular one that most people know about. However, in the industry and managed by this regulatory body called the PCI Security Standard Council, today there are as many as 15 of those standards, 15.
Wow.
Today, we're on version 4 of the PCI DSS standard, which has significantly evolved. But what's notable is the previous major version, version 3, came out in 2013 to become effective in 2014. Even though it has a few iterations since then, so basically version 3.2.1 was replaced by version 4, you could still qualify it as a nearly 10-year-old standard. So version 4 is well overdue. And those standards are now managed by this PCI SSC, Security Standards Council, which is an independent body created by those card schemes to deal with that. And the council has different role from the card schemes. It's quite complex also.
So what would you say is the biggest changes between the version 3 and 4 that we're now using?
As I said previously, version 4 is a little bit overdue, one can argue, for two reasons. There's been a lot of technology and innovation advancement which had to be addressed. And naturally, also the threat landscape has evolved. For example, version 4 introduces 64 new requirements. If you count compared to the old standard, that is a 25% increase. Yep. And 51 of those are so-called future dated, because from the date of publication of the standard, organizations are given 3 years to basically prepare and deploy those because they are considered costly and complex. And most of them are technology related. I'll just give you one example. It may be a little bit technical, but so one of the changes is to address the threat from criminals compromising payments pages or payment websites. What criminals have done historically is they have shifted from the lowest hanging fruit as the industry secures the ecosystem to the next one. And basically what criminals are able to do by compromising a website, they can inject their own JavaScript, which can collect or harvest payment data without altering the original flow. So they can be sitting there for days, weeks, and months undetected, collecting sensitive data. So the standards introduced two new requirements mandating that organizations need to monitor and authorize any scripts that are running on their pages. And this requires new complex tools that many organizations are unprepared for.
And there's quite a big change as well to vulnerability testing, because I believe under the version 3, you do have to do a vulnerability test, you do your pen test, but you don't actually have any push to really fix it. You can just schedule it at a later date potentially. Whereas in the version 4, they're very specific on, we want you to do 4 a year at least, and we do actually need to see some changes for the auditors. That did seem to be in there.
I'm going to slightly disagree. the change is slightly different, actually. They always wanted to fix things, but they have introduced another technical requirement, which I could have given as an example as well. And it goes like this. Previously, you had to perform a vulnerability scan.
Yeah.
But now, when you perform a vulnerability scan, you need to provide the scanning solution with so-called administrative level credentials. Yeah. So the scanner is not now banging just like any hacker on a website or on an application. But these credentials enable the vulnerability scanner to actually log in and much more deeply analyze any vulnerabilities or secure misconfigurations.
Yeah.
As a result, you have two issues. You have to deal with a lot more bandwidth on your network because those scans are very deep and exhaustive, but they also find a huge load of vulnerabilities and issues that you haven't seen previously.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. The bandwidth issue means also you can break your environment. So you really need to think about testing and service windows and all of those kind of things. But the new load of vulnerabilities that you're going to have to fix is really scary because the level of inspection you're able to do with this is on another level.
And anyone who's worked with PSI machines as well will know that bandwidth is a big issue, particularly with certain brands and the Wi-Fi. They will, you know, I get called out for it with one particular brand more times than any other brand. And you think, well, is that going to have more issues with the software? Is it going to have more issues in that way? Is it maybe requiring more bandwidth? So we're going to see, I guess, a few IT professionals, even if they're outsourcing their PCI requirements, they're still going to have to make changes and adaptations, I guess.
Yes, big time. I mean, there's a lot of new technology that needs to be implemented that will have heavy duty impact on your operation. And the problem that we see nowadays is there is an acute shortage of cybersecurity professionals. So organizations will struggle to attract and retain such talent. Of those 64 new requirements, 29 are highly technology-related ones. They would most likely require organizations to acquire or introduce a new technology into their environment, new security technology, obviously.
So when we're thinking about the maybe the small guys then in the mix, like charities, theatres, maybe like an ice cream or burger van. Does it kill their? Does PCI actually kill their businesses? How does it? How much cost is it going to sort of bring up to make sure that you're compliant? And
so there's no easy answer here, that because there's a few different angles. So those entities that you described, they're classified as merchants. Mm-hmm. Who offers a product or a service and takes a payment with it.
Yeah.
Thankfully, the compliance regulations take into account the number of transactions processed annually. So they actually categorize the merchants into level 1 through 4, with level 1 being the highest number of transactions, mm-hmm. and level above 6 million, and level 4 as little as 20,000 or less. So the reason why they categorize them is because this poses a different risk. And it categorizes them also because obviously a bigger organization can afford to be, if I can use that word, assessed or inspected, mm-hmm. by an external third party. In the industry, we call them qualified security assessor. Yeah. Whereas the smaller merchants are given the right to perform a so-called self-assessment. Mm-hmm. Now, it is very important not to mix self-assessment with compliance, because they still have to comply to the same standard. It's just that the check is done internally, self, as opposed to somebody external.
Yeah.
And it goes without saying that when somebody comes and inspects it, there's a different level of validation and quality of that assessment. But last but not least, generally the providers of solutions for payments to the small merchants also play a very important role, especially through innovation. So as I mentioned earlier, there were as many as 15 PCI standards, and one of them is called P2PE, which stands for point-to-point encryption. So this is a hardware-related standard, which actually focuses on our favorite now post-terminals. And what this standard ensures is that the cardholder data is encrypted inside the terminal and sent over the wire in such a way that even the merchant cannot decrypt it. Mm-hmm. So what that does is it basically removes other redundant now requirements for the merchant to worry about the network security or about the encryption and so on and so forth. So what becomes important as final words for merchants is to actually select the right acquiring or merchant bank, acquiring and merchant are interchangeable, or a payment gateway, payment service provider who would offer them solutions that would reduce the scope of their PCI compliance by using technology. This was just an example for card present transactions, but you also have similarly technologies that can minimize the compliance and therefore, the other way around, that minimizes the scope and therefore the compliance exposure to small merchants in the e-com space. And ultimately, merchants can so-called outsource all of the technology processing to payment gateways who themselves are PCI compliant, so the merchants don't have to. Now, when I say don't have to, that's not entirely accurate, but they just have a very small bit left for themselves. So merchants need to educate themselves and work with innovative, trustworthy and reputable companies. That would help them a lot.
I'm sure we're going to see prices rise for those guys with the new introduction of version 4, where they get their new staff on board and deal with it. But yeah, it's a good change. And I guess as security professionals, we're happy. It's been overdue. We've needed this for a long time. And on that note, I think Ed would like to ask questions about fraud.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things on the topic of fraud. One being, you know, something that we've seen a lot is actually in-person processing of payments, such as, you know, we see a lot of shoulder surfing, PIN numbers, maybe collecting ticket receipts with account numbers, even fake ticket inspectors that can kind of swipe card information, near field passive fraud as well, using contactless payments. And also we see a lot of fake and modified POS terminals. I was wondering if you kind of had any opinions on how we can prevent those things from a security point of view going forwards with new standards and actually implement them in an effective way.
Sure. Well, to again politely and diplomatically a little bit, not disagree, but introduce a little bit of a controversy here. All of those fraud techniques are absolutely true and valid. I would consider them a little bit old school for two reasons. One is that, we have the classic cat and mouse game between criminals and the payment ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the truth and the reality is that those some 15 PCI standards have actually minimized some of this fraud to negligible levels. And generally, the card schemes as well as the PCI Council put lesser emphasis on the security of an individual transaction or individual case. And as you can imagine, some of those that you mentioned, they're like very specific. So if you do shoulder surfing for a PIN number, you'd be getting one PIN at a time, and then you need to be sure that you have also the card number.
Yeah.
Then by way of example, the ticket receipts, PCI DSS requires that for any printed receipts, the first six or any other four digits only printed, unless absolutely necessary. And you can imagine that with the first six and last four, a consumer would easily be able to identify, oh, I use this card. So there's really no need to print the whole card number. And that's why I was saying that this is a little bit of thing of the past. But nowadays, what we're dealing with is much more sophisticated fraud. I'll give you one example. It's called the APP fraud, which means authorized push payment.
Yes.
Where criminals trick people into authorizing payments themselves, usually through some mobile device. And it requires a little bit of social engineering. So you can think about it as approving a transaction by just saying okay on a phone. And because this feels so normal, the request is coming from someone we trust and we're used to, it can happen. And again, the difference between this and some of the other examples, not all of the other examples, is that this can be done on a massive scale without actually requiring, you know, a lot of personnel or physical presence. It can be done remotely. It can scale a lot.
So are people too trusting is the question for that. Are people too trusting? You know, sometimes a person just wants to wave a machine at you and you obligatorily just hold up your phone or your card. And I see that all the time. And I've said to friends, like, did you check how much the merchant put in? Oh, no, I didn't. So I'll check the bank statement later. It's like, yeah, if you're buying off, you know, a merchant in the street who's got maybe a van and moves on, you're not going to, how are you going to get your refund? So I guess that maybe we need to educate people and to be a little bit more guarded as well, rather than relying on just that compliance for us.
100%. So this is the ever existing challenge between convenience and security. The truth is you can't fully have both. If you want convenience, it usually lowers your guard and the security and vice versa. And it's an ever rebalancing game. Innovation requires convenience, and then fraudsters and criminals find a way to exploit the human nature. So, often also innovation outpaces security, which has to be bolted on later on based on some bitter learned experience. So, organizations, especially those that develop those payments, have learned some hard lessons because security compromise, data leak have caused serious reputational damages. So they do try to take care. And just for a second to go back, because there's a brilliant example on your previous questions about some of the fraud and for example, tampering POS terminals. Mm-hmm. So PCI P2P ensures now that POS terminals are very difficult to tamper because there's tamper-resistant hardware. Mm-hmm. And there's a requirement by the shop owners to conduct regular tamper inspections to see that somebody hasn't connected a cable or a reader or broken a security label. Mm-hmm. So this is also links to this current question in terms of how we develop a certain technology. It's very technologically convenient, and then we have to bolt on security to prevent new and innovative ways by the criminals to tamper with us.
Yeah, we have to be right 100% of the time, and they've only got to get it right once, and they make a load of money. So, and there's more of them than there probably are of us with the skills gap. So it's quite a lot of work that we do in cybersecurity that often doesn't get noticed, I guess.
Welcome to our workplace cybersecurity training. Training with Boudica is a different experience. We offer very high academic quality, accessibility, flexible study, and high outcome impact. Our course is unique and specially built by an expert team of university professors to deliver the same standard of teaching you'd find at a top university, but condensed and tailored for beginners. If you're interested and want us to be part of your journey to better company cybersecurity, contact us at Boudica. We'd love to hear from you. Connect by following the links or visit our website, boudicasecurity.com, for more details.
I think an important question leading on from fraud and also talking about the hardware protective sort of resilience is, given the diversity of both software and hardware and the range of payment systems that we see, and obviously we have regulations for a reason, where does the responsibility actually lie there with actual providers and also the merchants? Who would we kind of, is it a 50-50 split between the actual payment processors, or is it lying on the merchant to keep those checks up to date? Who do we kind of swing the responsibility to? Is it an equal balance, or is it very heavy-handed on one side?
We organize a different podcast for this topic. No, I'm kidding. It's so large and it's so complex. So just a couple of examples. People don't realize the number of players in the ecosystem. Let's take, for example, a POS terminal. POS terminal has to be manufactured somewhere. You have the whole supply chain issue security. Do you remember the recent issue with some pagers exploding somewhere? think of a POS terminal as a device that you need to securely manufacture in terms of all of its security components. Then you have the so-called key injection so that it can encrypt and securely communicate. Then you have to think about the security of transportation and storage. And also you have to think about the security while it is being deployed and in use. There are different entities in all of this process, and they all have different responsibilities. The different PCI DSS standards deal with this. But probably your question comes a little bit more from a consumer perspective. Somebody used my credit card, my stolen credit card, used it on a website, and I have this unauthorized payment. You know, who's responsible for it? And again, this is complex, but I'll try to explain it with an example. So strictly speaking about e-commerce and the stolen card used on, let's say, an airline's website, the liability would shift between the merchant and the issuing bank, depending on the implementation of a so-called PCI 3DS standard. So PCI 3DS standard is this standard that when you make an online payment, it requires you to authorize the payment through some other channel, either through tap on your phone or an SMS or an email, right? Yeah. So if the merchant, the airline, hasn't implemented this standard, they would be responsible for paying the chargeback, even if they have nothing to do with that card being stolen somewhere else. However, if they have implemented it, and if the process checks out because the fraudsters were able to have the SMS code or whatever, it's not their responsibility. So even this is quite complex, and we have only touched on the card-not-present channel. You have then all the POS terminal and card-present payments that have their own rules and regulations. It's not simple.
Could go on for hours.
So here's a good question, Martin. Do you still use chip and pin and contactless, or have you gone cash only?
No, I actually am a heavy user of contactless, whatever it is available, for the following reason. It is one of the most secure. It is secure because it came in quite late, so it has been designed with very, very good security. I'll fall back to chip and pin if that's what's available, and cash only when needed. Just to give you an example of a couple of the security features, and they're not like really the deep technological ones. They're just more facing the consumer. So with contactless, you will have a limit on the amount that you can spend. Above that limit, you will be required to enter your PIN code. When you don't enter your PIN code and you're doing a so-called offline transaction, imagine you're buying a drink on an airplane up in the air and there's no connectivity, your card will be adding up the sum of all of your transaction, and when a certain limit exceeds, it will ask for a PIN code. So you can see that it's quite not only convenient, but secure. And then all of the things that happen under the surface make it quite good. So that's my personal choice.
So has the drive for convenience potentially made us all vulnerable? Because as we know in security, when we look at that sort of system, that cash is still a bit more secure than payments at this moment in time. Why are so many dishonest claims made against it? Do you think it's just a power grab by banks to potentially, you know, control and have more of those payments go digitally and not have to print as much money, essentially?
Again, quite a complex topic, because cash, actually, a lot of people don't realize cash costs quite a bit to manufacture, transport, to secure. From a regulatory perspective, cash also is a big disadvantage in terms of avoidance of taxes and all kinds of criminal activity.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, electronic payments are all traceable, very fast, instant, very convenient. So there is this, constant battle between privacy and convenience and cost. I don't think that, I personally am of the opinion that banks prefer electronic payments purely for the convenience and cost.
True.
Once again, cash is very, very expensive, or has become very expensive to manage.
And,
Time,
and I'm trying to squeeze a few more in. So Google and Apple Pay don't conform to all of that monitoring that you've mentioned. And are big tech companies maybe getting past some of that PCI compliance in their own way? And I know that because I literally did some research on the ground myself with A Strange Man Dressed as a Clown in one of our previous shows.
Specifically speaking about the payment card industry and that compliance, I'm of the opinion that Google and Apple do comply, and they have one important reason or stimulus to do so. This is because any compromise that is linked to them and their name would cause the huge distrust among their consumer population. And even without that particular regulation, they still would be very much driven. And what I realize now, I could have mentioned a little bit earlier that actually fraud, which causes that distrust in the payment instruments of Visa and MasterCard, is the main driver why they're doing all of that security and compliance. Because they don't want their users to feel uncomfortable using such electronic payments and reverting back to cash. But it is true that in certain aspects, in certain areas, when we talk about the payment functions of that big tech, they have been less transparent or conforming to traditional monitoring.
Yes. Financial
oversight.
Regulations. Yeah.
Correct. That said, I'm of the opinion that regulators are catching up.
Yeah.
And there's a growing pressure. Yeah. It is true that And you named two very innovative companies, and you can imagine how they typically outpace the regulators. So that's it.
You meant?
It's basically innovation outpacing regulation. That's kind of probably how it can be explained. Is it right or is it wrong? It depends on the point of view.
Hey, innovation drives the economy. So I guess to some people, that's brilliant.
I think one important question is when we talk about regulation as well for money internationally, whether it's being transferred, whether it's through local point of sale payments, what are the biggest tensions that you might have seen regarding like actually regulating international money, and where do we see PCI come in there?
Look, I think that there's a few aspects to this. One side that I can think about is, are there worries about excluding people who don't have access to digital banking or digital payments, especially in poorer or rural areas? And think also of different countries, different continents, where you don't have a good smartphone or internet connection. Politically, cash is a big issue in terms of privacy and control. So fully cashless society could give governments and corporations more control. Cash, on the other hand, is seen as something that gives freedom and privacy because it can't be as well tracked and monitored. So where does PCI come into all of this is, well, it obviously cares only about the digital electronic payments side of things. And if those are to work, you really need that, because that payment ecosystem is like a little bit like a chain, and it's as strong as its weakest link. Like if you imagine how it's chained up, is you have the consumer going to the merchant, connecting to a payment gateway, connecting to an acquiring or merchant bank, going on to the Visa or MasterCard networks to reach the issuing bank, and all the way back. And imagine if there's also somebody who's doing fraud detection or, you know, some other specialized services. So many things can go wrong, or it can be so easily disrupted. So security becomes paramount. I mean, we see it in our world today, both in the cyber and kinetic warfare, how both government and private organizations have used cybersecurity to disrupt the operations of the enemy.
My kind of follow-up question to you then was, what's your opinion on Bitcoin, and what do you think happened in the progression of its use or degression, maybe?
Probably I'm not the best person to talk about this, because I'm quite conservative, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm of the opinion, I'm a little bit old style thinking in that respect. I'd like to think that Bitcoin is largely driven by greed and fear. It's not really underpinned by something physical or material. Mm. And if you bought a bar of gold, or if you bought shares in a company, even if things went really bad, you'd still be left with something. With Bitcoin, less so. I don't know if you're speaking specifically about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, the way it's organized, is that it's relatively speaking slow for transactions. So it's much more seen as a store of value, if anything. There are other alternative cryptocurrencies which are designed from the ground up for performance and speed and efficiency.
Yeah.
So... just one last thought is, what I know is that once those start encroaching too much on the territory of regulators, the regulators will step in and regulate it. It's not going to go forever being as free and as privacy oriented. Just the nature of the world we live in.
And where can people reach out if they are trying to get some maybe consultancy on this side of payment security, or they want to reach out to you directly at work? How can our audience contact you?
Well, absolutely. So obviously www.integrity360.com is the easiest one. My email address is martin.petrov@integrity360.com. And we'd like to believe that we are the number one qualified security assessor for the payment card industry in Europe, particularly anything related to your payments. And but not only, you're very welcome to talk to us.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.